It is my very real pleasure to introduce our moderator for today, and that would be Professor Thomas Frampton from the UVA School of Law. Professor, it's all yours.
First off, thank you so much to Senior Statesman of Virginia for having me moderate what looks to be a fantastic presentation and discussion with our two of our chiefs in the area. I'll start off by introducing Chief Lance, who's the Chief of Police for Albemarle County, who was previously the Deputy Chief until becoming Chief in 2016. Before that, he was at the Fairfax County Police Department, where he was a district station commander, overseeing 155 officers and providing police service to the 125,000 residents in Fairfax County. Also joining us is Dr. Brackney, who's the chief of police for Charlottesville. Dr. Brackney had a 30-year career with the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police and was also the chief of police for George Washington University before coming here. She has a PhD from Robert Morris University and bachelor and master's degrees from Carnegie Mellon University. So I'm going to take the privilege of asking the first question, and then I will try to incorporate as many questions from our audience as possible. I think for generally speaking, I'd ask to see if we can try to confine our initial answers to about 2 minutes, and then hopefully there will be opportunities for back and forth or further elaboration if that works for everybody. So my first question for both of the panelists, and you can take this in either order, whoever would like to go first, but in the academic literature, which I I drown myself in, there's some sense that community policing is a very popular catchphrase, but it's so capacious and broad that it means almost nothing and everything. Professor Stoughton at South Carolina said that the absence of a functional definition of community policing has led to an inevitable sort of implementation challenges and department resistances. So my question for you to get us started off is, what does community policing mean as practiced in your departments, and what should it mean?
So Thomas, you said 2 minutes to tell you what community policing means. I don't think that's possible. Thank you for having me on here today, me and Chief Brackney. I enjoy getting to sit down with my esteemed colleague over in Charlottesville, and we do a pretty good job of double teaming, but I can give you a really quick snapshot of what it means to Albemarle County Police Department. It's everything to Albemarle County Police Department. We went into this thing called geographic-based community policing in 2012 when I came here from Fairfax County. We divided the entire county, 726 square miles, into two districts. We assigned officers to the same beat, so they work the same area every night. So they get to know the community, they get to know the business owners. And we've built on that with our community policing. That's our neighborhood outreach, and that's coffee with a cop. We do putt-putt with the police, some people may be familiar with, just like Chief Brackney and her department do a lot of community outreach. We do that as well. And one of the things, to your point earlier about how to gauge if it's working, is in the police world, I know I use data for a lot of what I do. I know Chief Brackney does as well. Our calls for service originally went up, and that's a true sign that community policing is working because the community is comfortable now approaching the police and reporting crime, and that's what we wanted. Since the initial phase, our crime has gone down. Our violent crime is down some 30-some percent in the last 3 years. The other thing that it's done is reduced response times in the county because the officers get to know the area. They're working the same area. And the other thing it's done for us here in the county is it's built a lot of trust with our community. I talk to people every day in the community. Unfortunately, we're in the COVID world now. We're having to do this like this. It makes it a lot more difficult, but we love getting out and doing outreach in the community. And we've done a few things recently, just practicing the social distancing and following the guidelines, but it makes it a little bit more difficult. So that's a real quick snapshot, Thomas. I could talk for 2 hours on community policing alone, but I'll turn it over to my colleague.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. Actually, these are really important topics, and I always appreciate the opportunity to engage with Chief Lance because this is a very regional approach to how we we do policing in this community. So I take a very different stance on what does community policing look like. I actually pull away from it because of just the wide, broad range of the definitions and what that means. So here I've shifted it to talk about community policing are the things that we do. Our philosophy, though, we build those things on, those interactions, are relational policing. So building relationships so that we then can have the ability to implement the outreach efforts, the community policing efforts that Chief Lance so aptly described. So for me, I've been able to move away from the buzzword so that we don't find ourselves sitting in a space that we can never get out of, right, as we debate what the language means and the definition means. Ultimately, community policing was built on a philosophy of building relationships in the community so that you could then identify the type of police services the community wanted, needed, and deserved, as well as the engagement processes that the community wants and needs and deserves. And the challenge around all of these is that we've not come up with a certain metrics that is uniform across the nation to determine whether or not we're being successful. So the departments are often forced to create their own measures of success, like Chief Lance said. That may be an increase in 911 calls or a decrease in internal affairs or complaints about the community, about engagement around rudeness, discourtesy, et cetera. I've also tried to remove the romanticized version of what community policing means, because we often hear, well, back in the day, I knew the officer who walked my beat, and I knew that officer, and that's what they associate with community policing, is knowing one specific officer, much like the geospatial policing that Chief Lance has instituted. I've asked that we not have this romanticized version, because what we often hold on to, and I'll end this with this, is what we believe to have been the system and how it was operating previously, right? Everyone knew the officer on the corner because that neighborhood was also very stable as well, right? So there was a stability that was occurring on both sides. And in this very transient global community that we currently live in, and the way in which policing must occur, because you're doing larger areas with fewer resources, romanticizing that officer walking on the beat to think that that had some very real impact on crime often did not show statistically to have that kind of importance. It was the engagement and now the mobility that Chief Lance is talking about, where you can have a much broader impact.
Great. So I appreciate that introduction. We've already started to get questions in through the Q&A feature. So if you are watching this and have questions, please post them through there and I will be able to see them. And we've already got a great one that I will add a slight friendly amendment to. Across the country, there's been a lot of talk and discussion about whether or not police have been given too many tasks or obligations to perform in addition to their main role of keeping the community safe, or maybe as part of their role of community safe, and that there might be better entities or personnel to address some of those tasks and obligations. Have you encountered that? Do you think that's fair to say about your own departments? And the friendly amendment that I will add is, if that is true, how do we get from point A to point B? Should your budgets be cut to provide more resources for other agencies or other personnel? Or is that something that the police department can themselves handle and prioritize? And what are your thoughts about that critique?
Chief, would you like to hit this one first?
Sure, absolutely, because I'm hit every day with this as to what that looks like. So what's interesting in society is this. We identify a problem and then ask the same entities to find the solution to the problem, right? So you just even said it yourself, Professor, you know, should the police do this, and then should their budgets be cut in order to fund the new thing, right? So I have to identify the problem and then create the solution, which puts it right back into the policing entity again to handle whatever those societal ills are. So yes, they have absolutely been called to do many things. And I call it we have the 911 bucket. When we used to say, don't put all your eggs in one basket, we put all of our 911 calls in one bucket and in one basket. If there is a societal ill that's out there that we have chosen to ignore and not fund, we've required the police to do it and not increase their budgets to do that. So it's interesting. If you take away from my budget, it's not because it's I'm going to have less 911 calls that have to do with those persons who are experiencing emotional or mental crises, or person who is experiencing being unsheltered or homeless or transient, or the poverty, or those truancy calls or loitering and all the other things that we've criminalized in society, or that there's going to be any less calls for addiction. The interesting thing is if you take every penny from my budget today, we currently have no system set in place to take over what we are currently being tasked to do. Not only just through our budgets, legislatively, we are mandated to be part of the process, which people don't also understand, around emergency detention order or temporary detention orders or emergency custody orders. So take my budget today, you still have no system to do the what next. And there was a very interesting article out of Seattle that said just this. Now what? Now that you're not, the police are not responding, now what? Here in this region, now what? We are currently have a mental health system that is overburdened, and not enough caretakers and workers in the system, in which it's a typically not crisis, non-emergency system. Now what? So I think it's often unfair for the entity, particularly policing, to be asked to solve the exact same problem that you think that we've created.
Chief Lance, what do you think?
Well, that was a great response from Chief Brackney. I would add to what she had to say is, you know, we've been hearing this, you know, defund the police thing for a while, you know, for the last 8-9 months. And, you know, here in Albemarle County, I actually track the mental health calls for service each month that my officers go to, because that's a piece of time that they're spending on each call, for example. And we're averaging 70 a month just in Albemarle County. I don't know if Chief Brackney tracks those, but we do. And what we're finding is that officers are spending anywhere from 2 hours to 25 hours on those. We had one that was 25 hours. That's no joke. So what we've started to do here, and we're in the infant stage, and it's going to be mandated to us, like Chief Brackney said, there are several things that we're required to do by law. But one of the things that's coming down the pike in the next 2 years is we are going to have a team that's got a police officer, social services. We have to have a policy in place where they go out to some of these mental health calls for service as a team approach, and not just the officer being primary. So I met with my command staff literally 3 months ago, and we're going to try to get ahead of the curve. We're already working on that process. We've invited Region 10 to the table, the Commonwealth Attorney to the table. So we're already in those discussions, because I can tell you, if there was a way for us to be able to handle those type of calls and not involve a police officer, I'm all for it, just like Chief Brackney would be. And then they could go do other law enforcement functions. But to take money away from my budget, which right now is hemorrhaging over the last 2 years, because of, you know, the economy and COVID, wouldn't be a way to improve the current process, because you're going to have to use what you have in place. And it's like Chief Brackney said, if this goes away, we're not doing this anymore, then something else is going to pop up that we're going to be required to handle on a regular basis. So those are the things that I have my eye on, particularly when it comes to that. And one of the other things we've learned from COVID is we don't have to respond to every single call for service. We can handle them over the phone. We knew that, but customer service wise, you call us, we're coming out. You know, when in doubt, we'll call you out. We've been able to handle a lot of things over the phone. So that's also helped streamline resources, reduce fuel costs for us driving cruisers all over our giant county. So those are some of the things that we look at here, and we're actually keeping a close eye on, that we can post pandemic. Hopefully we'll find that day that we're able to continue to do the way we're doing things now.
That's really interesting about the COVID part. Could I ask you, Chief Lance, just to follow up briefly, you've got a couple more examples of one place where maybe in a previous day you would have sent the car out to the residents, but in these times you haven't?
Chief, you want to go next?
Yeah, I'll help him out just because I saw him taking a drink. And is my mic better now? I don't know. There were some issues with my mic. So not only just what we'll take the calls over the phone, we've expanded our online reporting, your ability to file a police report online. The whole concept is, and this actually is pre-COVID, the less interactions you have with a police officer, the less likely to have a negative outcome. wherever that outcome or that interaction is. So you can imagine, even just pre-pandemic or COVID, people were already agitated if there was an accident that they were involved in, or there was some property that was stolen. And then you introduce an officer into that who they don't believe are getting the type of service that they think they should be getting, right? Because they're already agitated, they're upset emotionally, they're already on a high. We're introducing officers into situations that have absolutely oftentimes nothing to do with them. And pre-COVID, we weren't using those systems as often, telephone reporting units or online reporting, because the type of customer service the community has often demanded is, I want to see an officer in person. And when you get those kinds of demands, you get that type of service. Partly what we need to do is re-socialize the community, change the community's culture and expectations of what does policing look like, and how do we renegotiate that social contract to get us to the place where policing is performed in a way that it's more high priority, high level public safety than it is with oftentimes social ills or, you know, quality of life calls that really we don't have the ability to impact.
And Thomas, I would just add to that. We've been doing the telephone reporting for some time. We've been doing the online reporting for some time, but we've really learned that how valuable it is. When you have to send an officer out in the middle of what we're in now with COVID, if they have to go to the scene of something, they have to have their protective gear on. We have our dispatch center screening the people that call in and ask to see an officer. So there's a screening process. The officer's being dispatched to the scene. And 99.9% of the time, we're asking them to meet us outside, which we always used to go inside and, you know, engage. So we've learned over this last 9 months that we can do business that way. We actually did a survey recently where our community that took the survey was satisfied with how we've been operating during COVID. One of the other things we've done, I know Chief Brackney had it happen down there, is access to our building still, for the most part, closed to the public. However, if you call ahead and set up an appointment, we're able to get people in. We used to get a lot of walk-in complaints pre-COVID, where they would show up in the lobby and make a lot of complaints that way. And now a lot of things are being done by the phone. And unfortunately, I typically have 6 to 8 officers on light duty at a time. And those are the ones that are assigned to taking those calls for service over the telephone.
Great. So I've got a question. I've got a few questions, one of which is about sort of what you'd like to see from organizations like SSV. And I can save that towards the end, I think, of our conversation. But I have a question I don't want to misinterpret the question, but the questioner asks, the Fifth Amendment guards offers a safeguard against government seizure of life, liberty, and property without due process. Yet some of these agents who we pay to protect us take our property illegally, and those properties are seldom returned to the owner. Policing for profit leaves the citizens with little recourse. Has this practice become inherently part of policing? So I'd like to break this down into two different parts. So one of them, I'm new to Charlottesville area from New Orleans, but the process of cell phones or wallets or other items that might have been taken during an investigation often go missing here. I have no firsthand experience with Charlottesville or Albemarle, but I want to ask, is that a problem that you've encountered? And if so, how is it being addressed? The second one is a slightly different one, which is related to a process called civil forfeiture, where it's not sort of disappearing into an officer's pocket. It's actually through a legal process. Police departments are allowed to seize property that was connected to criminal wrongdoing. And there have been a lot of critiques of that. The police have become too dependent in their own budgets or other practices on those sorts of civil forfeitures, which creates all sorts of perverse incentives. So the second part that I'm adding to this question is civil forfeiture practice or a common feature of policing in your departments? And if so, how much of that is in your budget, and should we be concerned about it?
Chief, I can start this one if you'd like this time.
Go ahead, because we both work on the same teams together.
That's right. About this much of our budget is seized assets, Thomas. We We have very little. I was speaking when I came on earlier with Rich. He got to seize assets. It has to go through a process, as you mentioned. The judge has to order it. It's not just the police officer seeing $1,000 on the table at a drug dealer's house, for lack of a better descriptor, and they can take that and then put it in a property room. It goes through the court process. The funds are very minimal here for Albemarle County, but that is a legal process that we go to. I have seen what you're referring to nationally. There has been some issues, and they're trying to engage some reform and seize assets. But there's one thing that people don't remember is I can't use that to fund reoccurring budget items. So I could not use seize assets to pay for salaries, things like that. So to answer your question first, because that was a good one, very minimal here in Albemarle County. And the second part you were talking about is like cell phones. I believe you mentioned cell phones and things, property went from where you're from going missing. That doesn't happen here. We have policies. I know Chief Brackney does as well. Policies in place that dictate when we're able to collect evidence and when we're able to take evidence. The thing that we will find policing in 2020 is everything is involving technology. Everything involves a cell phone, a laptop. Crimes are committed utilizing those. So they do have to be taken in an event to complete the investigation for prosecutorial purposes. But after that, the court can order release of the property back. And it's our job as the chief and the police departments to make sure that we maintain the property in the condition that we received it and return it to the owner once it's ordered to do so.
Right. So I would just agree with that. The first part is just clarifying the question, you know, that the properties are taken illegally. They're not taken illegally. We may not like the laws. We may not agree with the laws, but the asset forfeiture programs are all legal programs that are sanctioned with a lot of safeguards, et cetera. And as a matter of fact, across the nation, they're tightening them up about even when you can apply for the asset forfeitures. Before, they were pre-convictions, oftentimes charging. You would just be able to search warrant, take these because you believe they were proceeds of the crime. And that's how this comes about. It's if they were proceeds or actively involved in the crime, it's not like I can just decide to come in and take your cell phone because you have it. It has to have a connection to the crime, profiting off of a crime, not that they were just your properties and we just decided to come in and that is a benefit. That's the first. Second, you cannot base any of your budget on asset forfeitures. You can base no part of your budget. When you put your budgets in, they have to come from a revenue or funding source, like taxes, et cetera. And then you present your budget for approval through your budget, city managers, et cetera. What you're talking about and what has gone across is after the death of Michael Brown, people were saying that they had a for-profit policing in order to fund equipment, overtime, et cetera. They were engaging in citations, tickets, and traffic and this for-profiting because they were so underfunded. So the policing for profit is a very different as well. It is not asset forfeitures. It actually costs me money to be involved in the asset forfeiture process here. Time, technology, personnel, the number of paperwork, scrutiny, coming out of Richmond. It doesn't come out of localities. It is governed in by the state. And then we have to participate, validation. And then, you know, I see a quarterly profit, much like someone else that says, hey, my budget is currently $18 million. And my asset forfeitures funds are typically around $1,200 a quarter. It is not, you know, we're not basing that on, but it is a very real concern when you hear about them across the nation that could this be happening here? And Chief and I are not blind to the fact that corruption occurs. And, you know, whether we like it both or not, there's corruption in every department, right? It depends on what that corruption looks like. But in terms of properties and monies and asset forfeitures, you know, our evidence, body-worn cameras, they are constantly on as well. So there are a lot of checks and balances that may not have necessarily occurring that didn't occur in the 1990s and early 2000s, when this policing for profit was definitely part of the culture of the criminal legal system.
Great. Fascinating answers. I have a question that I'll combine with one that we've just seen. Across the country, there are progressive prosecutors who are being elected on reform agendas, oftentimes promising not to prosecute low-level drug offenses or making other reform promises. Some of the folks in the audience, George Gascon just became the DA in Los Angeles. Jason Williams was elected DA in New Orleans on Saturday. And oftentimes in other cities, I don't want to speak about it here, there's been tension between the elected prosecutors and particularly rank and file officers who might have very different visions or views or understandings or assumptions about what criminal justice should look like. Have you, because we have had people run under the progressive prosecutor label around here, have you seen any of that tension? And if so, how is it being addressed and negotiated? Related to this, the question that came in is, what kind of implicit bias training do officers receive in Charlottesville and Albemarle, and how often?
I can start really quick, Chief, if you want on this one. My entire department goes through implicit bias training at the Academy, just like Chief Brackney's, and we do additional training here. Once they get to our building, they also go to an annual implicit bias training, de-escalation training. You name it, they go through it. As far as the prosecutor's concerned, our prosecutor has been in place almost a year. January will be 1 year. And he and I meet frequently. As a matter of fact, I had him on my Citizen Advisory Council meeting yesterday. And some of the things he was talking about was that first offense, nonviolent crime diversion. And I fully, as a chief, support it. As a matter of fact, I've gone and visited Jay James several times, and he's trying to do something just like that over in Buckingham County, where that low level, first time offense, Jay's actually teaching them a trade, getting them deferred from court and prosecution, teaching them a trade and helping them get a job once they get out of the program. So we're not seeing an issue. And I would imagine Chief Brackney is not either, because we understand that, that if you can get to it early and you can get people down the right road and get them off the bad track, it's very helpful. So we're working on several different projects right now with our Commonwealth attorney just to address what you're speaking of. We were a part of that one for some time with shoplifting. We partnered with a group that did that, and they wanted to defer the first-time shoplifter, particularly the juveniles, and not have them criminally charged. So in my department, I'm not seeing any issues or pushback from any of the deferrals from my rank and file. They're doing their job, and their job is to enforce the law and pass it on for prosecution. And the prosecutor's job is to determine what they want to prosecute and what are they going to defer. So that's kind of what our mindset is here.
We have a slightly different in Chief Lance approach. They just changed over from their Commonwealth attorneys last year. And their elections were just that. One who was saying very progressive, reformist. Another one who said, okay, there's need for change, but until that, we tend to go very, traditional procedural approaches. Our Commonwealth attorney came on just months before I was hired here, ran on a very progressive agenda. I've probably been, I'm not the one in council that or in the Senate that are living the most progressive person, but I'm probably one of the more liberal progressive chiefs in the region. So, that has been helpful for the two of us. We are very vision and value aligned. We both are very active in Fair and Just Prosecutions organization. And if you just notice, we both agreed and we've signed off on, the stopping these rapid executions. We've worked with our team and Chief Lance's team has as well with the prosecutors or the Commonwealth attorneys in both of our regions to allow people to be released on home electronic monitoring, that we actively participate in those during the COVID era? And is that an opportunity that if we could do that during the COVID era, where you release people from jails as being nonviolent, non-threat, repeat possibilities of being repeat offenders, why can't we use that as a model when we're not in the COVID era, right? So if it's working during this time frame, why might it not? Now, that does not mean everyone is on board throughout every agency. There are people who believe, you know, the old school Beretta, and I'm going to probably date myself, you know, if you do the crime, you do the time. But that is a very punitive system in which this has been built on. In terms of implicit bias training and other training, again, I don't want us to get caught up in buzzwords, because we hear these buzzwords and think that these are, you know, the panacea to correct all of the cultural indoctrination, blue socialization that goes on in our profession. So our officers, yes, they receive it. We just finished an entire week or more of training with the Anti-Defamation League on implicit bias and managing implicit bias. We take on much more than what the state mandates. The state only mandates here in Virginia, is it 2 hours, Chief Lance, of 4 hours of what they call cultural competency or cultural awareness classes. Mm-hmm. And it's not even regulated as to what would qualify as a cultural awareness or cultural, I mean, I call it cultural competencies. They call it those things. I call it cultural humility, because you're never going to be competent or proficient in every culture. But if you have a humility about how you're going to engage, it gets a different outcome. What we are finding, and again, this is the geek, the academic in me, and Professor, I'm sure you've looked this up as well, that the implicit bias training, de-escalation training, may be changing the way officers think. It's not necessarily changing the way they behave. And I'm finding there's a disconnect between here's the training and here's the real world application and the safe places to practice it. So where do you get to practice de-escalation implicit or bias targeting except on the job training? And that is not the place where you want to practice this. So we're working with places like Axon to create coaching scenarios and availabilities to look at tapes or interactions just like you would in football. What does that look like, you know, when you're studying your opponents? Go Steelers. I did say that out loud. What does that look like when you study, you know, how you played and how you might play and how the things have arrived? We need to have those same kind of opportunities when it doesn't create harmful situations for when we interact and out in the public.
Great. I will continue to take my prerogative to offer friendly amendments to these questions that we're getting, but we're getting great questions, so please continue submitting them. One of our participants writes that he recently heard on the radio that police actually are not legally required to protect a member of the public. So in this example, man who violated a stay away order and then killed his ex-wife, the police were ruled by the judge not to be legally liable for this failure. Is this true in our area? This is something I teach, so I guess I can just offer it very quickly, is that they're under the Constitution, there's no affirmative right to be protected by the police. So in this situation, a lawsuit against the police would almost always fail. So that's the short answer. But let me ask for a slightly longer answer, and specifically around this theme of community policing. It seems like there are these dual tensions that are sort of the opposite sides of the same coin, where there are certain communities that are underprotected, and at the same time, many of those same communities are the ones that feel the most over-policed. And maybe that's unfair, but is that an accurate statement? And are we just doomed to be in this paradox, or is it possible to give more protection to the underprotected while at the same time not over-policing those that already feel over-policed?
Chief, you want me to go on this one? So I can just tell you, from, I'm speaking Albemarle County, I'm not familiar with the case you were talking about, or, you know, nationally. People always ask me, nationally, we're seeing the trend in this. Well, I worry about Albemarle County because that's what I was appointed to the chief to worry about is my county and my citizens here and my police officers. So I'll speak to my county. I want everybody in this county, and I know Chief Brackney is the same way, regardless of where you live, who you are, your economic background, you receive the exact same quality service that anybody else would in this county. That's how we operate here. Yes, there are going to be times in the county where we have more calls for service in another community than we do in others. So we're going to see police there because people are calling us there and asking for us to intervene on their behalf for some reason. But on general patrol functions, getting out, meeting with community policing philosophy that we spoke about earlier today, it's equal across the board. As far as the level of service that everybody is given. And one of the things that everybody always talks about is over-policing a certain area and underserving other areas. The thing that people don't realize sometimes is we're being called into those areas for help. And when people call, we're going to go and we're going to respond. We're going to try to mitigate whatever issue they're having and fix it for them. So that's a quick answer to that could be a 2-hour discussion by itself. But I'll kick it over to Chief Bracken if she has anything she'd like to add on that.
Okay, I'm trying to unmute. I was not being inattentive. I was actually pulling up. This is actually Supreme Court rulings. These are not local rulings at all about what does police protections look like. And the reason I was looking it up is because we had in Charlottesville individuals file complaints after the events of August of 2017 for failing to protect them against the Unite the Right rally and the violence that occurred after the fact. So literally what they accused us of, and this is exactly probably what the lawsuit was you're talking about, accused them of, or whoever read it, was of malfeasance or misfeasance or nonfeasance of duty, failure to performing their duties to do that. And the Supreme Court ruling that came out that says specifically on this is that it falls under equal protections under the law. And according to those, you cannot be deprived. The U.S. Supreme Court in the Castle Rock versus Gonzalez, the government, its agents are under no general duty to provide public services such as police protections to any individuals. And Castle Rock doctrine can be applied. So you can have that in your back pocket for the next course that you teach about there is no duty to protect. However, that doesn't mean there isn't a desire, as Chief Lance said, to protect. You want to provide protections and services. And the arguments here in Charlottesville have been just that, that there are certain communities that are over-policed and under-protected. They aren't provided with the same type of services. What is interesting is because sometimes that's a public-facing argument. And then when you're having the closed behind door discussions, those same persons who are screaming that you are over policing, they are asking for you to over police. And to police, to be present. Now, there's also a distinction between over policing and police presence. Often you will have someone argue they're being over-policed just because the police are there. And that is a huge distinction as well that we all need to make. But we must acknowledge historically that Black and brown and poor communities have been over-policed. And why? Because it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you spend lots of time in a community, you're more likely to see things that are going on in that community. And then you start to rack up your data that says these things are happening, right? That this crime is occurring. And then the more you see that data says these crimes are occurring, the more you're likely to be in that community again, so that you continue to over police. And I think it's Khalid Muhammad out of Harvard who talks about this data reinforcing that you then create those conditions in which you find yourself shoring up your statistics, right? And this becomes your real truth. So there are opportunities for us to engage the community as to how they want and deserve to be policed. And I talk a lot about renegotiating that social contract for policing and feeling safe and doing it in a just manner, not just equitable, a just manner. Which is very different than, you know, and it builds on what Chief Lance said, that we police equitably.
Chief Brackney, you brought up recent protests. Are there blueprints or plans in place at either the city or county level to be more prepared for the next large protest, whatever the political ideology or valence of those protesters might be?
I don't think either one of us has ever been unprepared.
Yeah.
This region has not has been prepared or having to prepare since the events of August of 2017. So we stay at a state of readiness and what that looks like. So when the rallies, marches, and demonstrations occurred here in Charlottesville and in Albemarle, we had our response already in place. And as a result of that response that we had in place, we didn't have incidents of cars being overturned, officers being assaulted, people being arrested, windows being broken. We had the plans in place that we have utilized since 2018, and it's worked for us. It's been able to talk about authentic de-escalation. We presented it so there was never an encounter between officers and those persons who were participating and exercising their First Amendment rights to hold government accountable for what they believe were atrocities and wrongs that were sparked under the death of George Floyd.
And I would just add, as far as the county is concerned, same thing. We're always prepared. I've been asked multiple times, what do you think about the protests? And I talk about, you know, I look at the city, the last few that Chief Brackney had over there. I think they're awesome. The police department went to block the intersection. The folks got to get out and march and be heard. There was no violence, like Chief Brackney said. And I said, we did it right here in this region. That's what it's supposed to look. You're supposed to be able to get out and talk about what your views and opinions are and be safe doing it. And one of the big things that we deal with on a regular basis in the county is our county office buildings down in the city. Well, that's a nice corner point for everybody to come protest, you know, and hold the signs and things like that. So we're continually working with different groups talking about, okay, if it's Tuesday and it's cloudy, we can try to help you do this, you know. So we're always continually working with the groups to let them know what they can and can't do. And please, you know, people are using the sidewalk, please let citizens go by and things like that. So like Chief Brackney said, we're always prepared. We talk about it. If not weekly, it's definitely monthly in my command staff meetings in the event that we have something spark up in the county.
And Professor, just to add on to that, we even reframed the language that we were using so that it gave our officers a different mindset as well as the community. We did not refer to these as protests. We didn't call them riots. We didn't call them civil unrest, because that already starts to put you in a mindset of an adversarial relationship. We talked a lot that these were rallies, these were marches, these were demonstrations in order to exercise their First Amendment rights to hold government accountable. And when you start to think of it in that framing, it also then tells the community, we hear you and value you. And that if there's any sort of escalation and violence, it's not coming from our mindset. It's always going to be, we're allowing you to be heard and you should be heard. And this is an expression. And even if that expression violated local ordinances, like shutting down streets or sidewalks and things of that nature, that was what we were willing to do for the bigger picture, to allow people to express their First Amendment rights, that we were going to constantly balance people's accesses and conveniences, right? That we might have to detour traffic with their safety and security so that they could be heard.
Great. Thank you for those very detailed answers. We've got a couple questions now, so I will wrap them together. What can those who are listening on this call or participating as interested and engaged citizens do to support your community policing efforts? If you had a wish list or homework assignments to give folks who are listening, what would that look like?
Well, I'll shoot from the hip on this one really quick. We do a Citizens Police Academy every year, so please, 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 if you're interested, reach out to me. That way you get to know what we do a little bit better. We're also going to have a teen police academy where we can have once COVID's over. Secondly, we have a foundation. I have so many boards. If you're interested, you could come serve on. And the last thing I would say quickly is tell your neighbors about the police departments, that you get to listen directly to both chiefs today, which is not often. Chief Brackney and I, our schedules are made out, what would you say, Chief, 3 to 4 or 5 months in advance, that she and I are able to get together like this. And I think it's wonderful. And talk about to your neighbors and your friends and families and what you've heard from today and what Chief Brackney and I are trying to accomplish with our community of policing initiatives and making our communities a safer place to live and work. And I think that would help us immensely. And I always tell folks when they're in a group and they hear me speak, if I do a public speaking engagement, is please tell others in the community what you heard today and not just keep it to yourself. And that usually helps spread the word.
Chief, what's the police academy that you referenced and what does it look like?
Well, it's 7 weeks long. We do it one night a week. It's usually Monday nights from 7 to 9. And literally, it's an academy for citizens to come in and see what we do for defensive tactics, driver training, report writing, you name it, traffic stops, building searches. And they get to ask a bunch of questions about why we do what we do. And it's wonderful interaction with the community. And again, I always make them, as I give them a speech at the beginning and the end, go out and tell 2 or 3 friends of what you learned here today and get 2 or 3 more to come join us the next time. So it gives people a very good perspective of what we do. Instead of, you know, like when they watch stuff on TV, the crime shows that I don't watch, where they saw the crime in 42 minutes minus the commercials, really happens in law enforcement, and we give them reality. And I think it bodes well for our community to really understand it.
So thank you. I agree with Chief Lance. The part that I would hit even harder, so you'll hear this before anyone else, is tomorrow I'm going to be doing a press conference on a recent incident that occurred in Charlottesville. And what I am disappointed about is the lack of grace in this community, and the willingness to just believe the worst about each other, either in the community or about the officers. And I know the community has been traumatized. I am not undervaluing the impact that 2017 has had. But I would ask that we be responsible consumers, informed consumers of information, and knowing what your police department does and doesn't do. Don't jump into the social media fray and start bashing or demanding without being an informed consumer. So as any individual, and part of that informed consumer process is going through the police academies. Chief Lance, they put on once a year. Charlottesville normally would put those on twice a year, but we're revamping ours as well to change it from a Citizens Police Academy, to more of a community police academy, in which we would also bring in community persons to speak about how policing has impacted them, so that there's an education that's a 360 approach to all of this, and not just, hey, yes, you're being welcomed into our world, but here's the impact of when our worlds come together and how we might do this better, right? So there's those lived experiences and then shared experiences, but it also then gives the community an opportunity to talk directly to officers without the accusation venting, because we're all in a safe space together where we're trying to learn from each other. But as everyday citizens who are impacted by policing, who live in our communities, who are served by our communities, the comment is, the final one is, if you are going to leverage your voice, please do so in a way that is responsible, and don't become this silent majority who continues to think these things, but never is as vocal, because then someone else is controlling in your narrative all the time. And I think that's where the disconnect, that the community orient policing concept, we keep forgetting that there is a community portion, and it falls solely on the police community relations. We're forgetting that there's the community part and that we all need to be more engaged.
Well, Chief Brackney, I taking your guidance and suggestion, I do not want you to address any specific incidents or any particular encounters, but one feature that seems pretty clear across the board in terms of promoting better police community relations is promoting confidence that when there are incidents of police misconduct or officers not following proper use of force protocols, that there is accountability or correction mechanisms that are in place. Can you talk a little bit about, for both of your departments, whether there are mechanisms that are in place now to ensure that the good ones move up and that the bad ones move out or otherwise sort of brought into line with the, sort of the vision of policing that, that you're trying to promote?
Chief, you want me to go first on this one? So great question, Professor. Again, I can talk for 25 minutes on this because I get passionate about it. Yes, there's mechanisms in place, and yes, Chief Brackney and I only hire and want the best of the best of the best to wear our uniform and protect our community. And that's every chief and every sheriff. The realization is that that's not always going to be the case. Some are going to slip through the door, and it's my job as a chief to make sure we catch them and weed them out. And I've done so in the last almost 5 years I've been chief in Albemarle County. As far as the complaint system, any complaint that goes to internal affairs is directly reported to me, the chief of police, and I do that because I take them that seriously. So I review them as well. I assign them to the internal affairs detective, and that's our more serious offenses of alleged misconduct. It could be racial profiling, anything like that. I'm sure Chief Brackney has a similar system set up. So there are systems in place. I now have an IA Pro system, which I've been begging for, and I finally got a year and a half ago. And literally what that is a system that tracks internal affairs complaints, but it also has a flagging system built in. So if I have an officer that used excessive force three times over a 6 month period, although they may have been in compliance, it's still going to flag it. And and that's going to determine a couple things. Do we need to do some additional training? Is there a situation that we need to address with this officer? So we have some great training in place. We have some great programming in place. And more important than that, as I said earlier, you got to make sure you get the right people in place. And that's promoting the right people. It's hiring the right people. And we've done a really good job here of doing that. Because, you know, unfortunately, in my career here, I've gotten rid of some people. And it could be something so simple, so simple. And I say this, Professor, every time I hire somebody, I give them the exact same speech at my desk. If there's something you're found guilty of, for lack of a better term, involving integrity, I will fire you post haste. Post haste, lying, stealing, cheating, whatever it is, you're gone. Because if law enforcement can't keep the trust and the credibility, we've got nothing. So we weed those out here. And I know that's been a large topic nationally about weeding out the bad apples. And one of the laws that came out of Richmond, and there were 562 of them coming out of there in the last 90 days telling police chiefs how to be chiefs and what's the best for policing. And I wish they would have invited me down. I would have been able to help out. I've been doing this since 1988. But one of the things that I do agree with 100%, and I call it the bad apple list, one of the things they're bringing out of Richmond is literally if somebody is let go from another department, if I let somebody go from Albemarle County and they apply with Chief Brackney, they can be decertified because they've had something involving integrity. And I would be able to pick the phone up and call Chief Brackney and say, don't hire this individual. They don't want to be wearing a badge in Virginia and elsewhere. So I support that 100%, and that's one of the things I was very vocal about this past cycle for the special session.
So we agree. My joke to Chief Lance all the time is when he says, hey, have your people call my people? I'm like, your people are my people. because they really do want to stay in the region, right? And they want the best of the best here. My philosophy is you start right at the door. Don't let them through the door. I am the most critical when we do these reviews of their jackets and when they're being presented right from the door. And what I say is I can train you in any skills, knowledge, abilities. I can train you to do the right things in policing. What I refuse to even entertain is trying to train you in ethics, morals, and character. I can't do that. And I'm not interested in that as well. When we have systems in place, we do have systems in place. And this is something I'll be adding next year. So you're hearing it first. And if there's some reporter on here who's in as a statesperson and has the reporter hat on the same thing, I'm sure they're going to publish it. But on our internal affairs, on our website, we post every internal affairs complaint. When it came in, when it was closed, we added this year a summary of the complaint. So what does that complaint look like? The disposition, how we found it, the race and gender of the officer, the race and gender of the complainant. Those are all on there. What I'm now going to add is the outcome. So if it was sustained, it'll be very generic because we don't identify the officer. There's personnel issues. It'll be very generic that says, you know, instituted training, they were counseled, they were suspended, they were demoted, whatever that is. That'll start in January 1st, adding that additional component, just because I don't want to have to try and go back and put that on for all the ones for 2020. So that'll be another one. Again, starting to add that component. In our complaint, internal affairs, we have a checklist, and they have to have in each complaint. So when I receive the final complaint back, I am similar to Chief Lance. Every complaint comes to me. Every complaint goes directly to internal affairs. And then based on our matrix, whether it stays there, whether it's just investigated in the branch that what it had occurred into, I look at every one of those. But there's a sheet that says the beginning of it that immediately puts the officer's complaint history right where the investigators can see it right from the beginning. And that helps them already set the mindset of where we're looking at trends, credibility, et cetera. Chief Lance and I both, neither of us have what's called a do not call list. The do not call list is when you have prosecutors that say you cannot have this officer come to the stand, do not subpoena, because they have some issues. I don't maintain a do not call list, because if you have to be put on a do not call list, add them to the do not employ list. You will not work for this agency. And we're not saying that either of our agencies is perfect. Please don't walk away saying that, you know, we have the halo light, although Chief Lance says have kind of a halo-y light behind him right now. But we are doing our best to ensure that our teams are working to excellence at all times.
I'll ask a somewhat pointed follow-up since you only because you opened the door, Chief Brackney, but do either of your departments have officers to the extent that you know that are on a local prosecutor's do not call list?
Oh, we do not. That is very clear. So the local prosecutor is the Commonwealth's attorneys. He doesn't believe in a do not call list, and neither do I. As a matter of fact, even after some of my internal affairs findings, in case I was concerned that these may have Giglio implications, I've taken the case, my internal affairs case, and said, look at this for me, because I'm not sure if this would qualify. And he's like, okay, you're just being a little too, you know, but I would rather have that much more robust review of any case where I'm not sure if those would legally apply, because I'm not an attorney, for those attorneys who are on here. And you know, Doc, you may be able to explain Giglio and what the implications are for police officers being able to testify in court.
So I'll just very briefly, for those on the call, there is a Supreme Court rule that says basically evidence that's in the possession of the state that reflects adversely on the credibility of a witness ought to be turned over to the other side, that the Constitution requires that. So in many of these cases involving police discipline, there's questions as to whether or not it might adversely affect the officer's credibility, which is what the chiefs are referencing here. While we're on this topic, and Virginia might be a little bit different nationally than national, so I think this is where this question is coming from, but teachers, nurses, doctors, et cetera, are certified by the state. Would you consider state certification for police? And I'll let you talk about what Virginia does in terms of decertification and new laws that have come out just in recent months. But related to this, there's in the academic scholarship, there's been a lot recently about these wandering officers. So officers who might resign from another police department before any kind of formal discipline and then can apply to another department and say, well, no, I've never been fired or disciplined elsewhere, and they'll be truthful. Chiefs, is that something that you have seen? You've both mentioned the hiring process. And what do you think ideally the certification process should look like here in Virginia?
That's a great question. I mentioned that earlier about the bad apple list. I mean, that's that officer before they are terminated, you know, for a truthfulness issue, let's say they say, no, I resign. And they go to Cornfield County, Virginia Sheriff's Department. I just made that up. And they apply and they say, hey, I want to come here and work. And we're not able to tell that person that's hiring them anything. Hey, they left your department other than would you hire them or not? That's all there. Would you rehire this individual? I think, Chief, is exactly the question that I get asked. And that's the only thing I'm allowed to answer. We are certified through the state, just like the teachers are. The difference between police officers, and I don't know how it works for teachers, but we're mandated by the state to have 40 hours of training every 2 years. That's just the basics. That's not counting the 20-week academy, the 10 weeks of Spartan, the 14 weeks of field training they go through, and all the reoccurring training that we send them through in order to be certified. And then it gets better. They have to go through driver training again. They have to go through handgun training every year. I'm going Monday. I always wait to the last minute. And it's always training to maintain that certification. So I guess the quick answer to that question is I completely support having a list that decertifies officers so they can't wear a badge and gun again if they are found guilty of violating integrity type of crime of moral turpitude, and we would get rid of them, and they should not be going over to fill in the blank department and being able to get a job wearing a different uniform. I hope that answered your question, Professor.
Yeah, and this is not a new phenomenon. Yes. Back in, you know, much like Chief Lance, I started in 1984. I violated child labor laws when they hired me at 3. So in my 37 years, but in the late 80s, early 90s, we called it cop scotching, like hopscotch, cop scotching, that you would jump from department to department to department to department to either avoid penalties, discipline, terminations, etc. Every state certifies their officers. So state certification is not new. I came from Pennsylvania. There is a post commission that certifies you as an officer. In Washington, D.C., when I was the chief there, there is a commission that certifies you as an officer in order to be able to operate. Virginia is no exception. What I have advocated for is national certification standards that, regardless of departments, you set standards, because any place of the 18,000 policing agencies across the nation that have more than 800,000 employees, we don't have standards across any of them, one, to form a police department, what it takes to be hired by a police department, or even when you're trained and brought into any police department. So Chief Lance is right. We need standards as to how you're hired, but also decertification standards. In Virginia, decertification can only occur after you've often been convicted of a crime. It doesn't occur prior to if you decide to resign or to leave the department. I've sent decertification requests in for two of my officers who don't meet the standards and have asked DCJS for waivers. Give me an exception to decertify these officers so that they can't go somewhere else. And I've had to beg them for the exception versus in reverse. This should be easy. If a chief comes to you and say, I want this person decertified, that's a win. So I think we would both we're comfortable with stricter standards. We're both comfortable with national or state standards. I don't want to speak in terms of national, but you could see if you have these agencies like the International Association Chiefs of Police who set national standards as to best practices, why wouldn't we all want to adhere to those?
I am not entirely sure what this question is. Perhaps you will know better, but should we respond to phone police solicitations? Are there times where your departments are gone. All right, I'm going to stop asking the question because you're both so vocally shaking your heads. But you want to maybe answer that in 15 seconds as opposed to 2 minutes?
Sure. Contact your local police foundation. So Albemarle has a Charlottesville Police Foundation. Charlottesville has a Charlottesville Police Foundation. You make the effort. Contact them first. Do not respond to any over-the-phone solicitations.
And I would just add, we had one 2 weeks ago where a citizen called me. Somebody was calling for the State Police Association requesting money, and I contacted the State Police. They do not do any telephone. They did years ago, but they don't do it anymore. So that's always going to be a bogus call. So contact us if you get those.
Great. And don't give anybody money who's called you first. Give no one money. I don't care if they say your grandchild is in jail and they need $5,000 and Walmart cards for you to get them out. Do not transfer. Do not give anybody money over the phone in which you did not initiate that call. You get free advice from us at the exact same time.
Fantastic. Well, I don't think that I've missed any questions in the queue, so I'll stick one more sort of round of back and forth for you on this question of sort of officer accountability. You've both talked about internal mechanisms. What external mechanisms should there be? And I know there's been a lot of tension and back and forth about a civil review board in Charlottesville. Is the notion of sort of civilian external oversight something that gets in the way of what y'all are trying to do within your own departments, or something that can ideally be something that works in tandem with your efforts to promote best practices?
I'm going to let Chief Lance take that one first.
So I'm very passionate about this topic, too. One of the other great things that came out of Richmond was the bill did not mandate a jurisdiction have a CRB. It gave that jurisdiction the ability to have a CRB. In Albemarle County, I have a Citizens Advisory Council, and I met with them yesterday, as I mentioned earlier, and it serves that same function. Now, Chief Bradley can tell you from years ago when her department 100 years ago up there in Pittsburgh went through the consent decree. Typically, the Justice Department, when they put a police department through a consent decree, Professor, you can explain what that means, orders them to have a CRB. This is where this all started, was a CRB for that. Yes, there needs to be some citizen engagement in what the police department's doing, and that's what I did yesterday. I love it. And I have a very diverse group. I have one of the people that sits on there is one of my board of supervisors as a liaison, so they get to hear everything that the police department's doing and what the citizens are telling me. But I don't believe, and this is just me talking, my opinion, sitting in this chair as a chief of Albemarle County, that it's good for every department. Some three people, four person department may not have the ability. And we have one down Scottsville, for example. They don't have the ability. We have a community college over here, for example. They just don't have the resources to be able to, for each one to have one of those type of boards set up. But I do believe in having an advisory council where you are held to task, so to speak, which I am bimonthly every Tuesday morning. It's my favorite meeting at 9 a.m. And I usually have some guest speakers come and talk a little bit about what we're doing, but I get asked tough questions. Like some of the good questions we've been getting here, we take a deeper dive in what we're doing in Albemarle County. So thank you for letting me get that part in. I was hoping that question would come up today.
So for me, so Pittsburgh was one of the first under the Uniform Crime Bill of 1994, which everyone just only remembers that it was three strikes. That's all you ever hear about, right? Super predators. But what was in that crime bill was the first time the Department of Justice was given the power and the authority to investigate police departments for patterns and practices of abuse, whatever that might be, right? And in Pittsburgh, we entered in a consent decree based on patterns and practices of what someone would now call stop and frisk, that they were being stopped without any reasonable suspicion to stop someone or they were being stopped. And then nothing else, you know, and it was young African-American men that were being stopped. So we entered into a consent decree. The city of Pittsburgh then put on a referendum, a question of would they want a civilian review board instituted and what that might look like, and the communities voted on it. And that's how most places get it. Either the community has it as part of a referendum, or as Chief Land said, it's part of the consent decree oversight process, which now mandates civilian oversight. And I was very comfortable working with Pittsburgh Civilian Review Board. I maintain and will continue to maintain. I am comfortable and welcome oversight. That is what government should get. I am always going to demand that it is fair, that it is well-trained, that it is not biased, and that it is not seeking retribution, that it is seeking review and oversight. And until we can agree on what the desired outcome is, are we using the mechanism in place that gets us our desired outcome? And I always worry about those kinds of things, is that do we have the system in place to bring about the reform that we're asking to do? And that, you know, all of this thing, the enabling legislation that just came out of Richmond around these boards, including offering the opportunity for civilians to have full binding discipline up to termination. And we're saying there's no requirements. I didn't see a single requirement that says this has to be a well-educated, trained, informed board. What criteria you would need to do that? And I argue over and over again, how do you have any sort of oversight, even in an accounting practice, or even in the law profession, or even in, you know, you have this, your university senates, right, that deal with professors who may have done something inappropriate. There's these oversight bodies that come from subject matter experts reviewing your behavior to see if that behavior was in alignment with your training, your policies, and your practices. And this is one of the oversight boards where there's not a single requirement to do that. And if there is to have somebody who has an opinion as a subject matter expert, in all of the legislation, it says they have no voting rights. They cannot have any influence. So when you have a board that is made up predominantly of citizens with the type of influence that we're being, that they will be granted in the community, I worry that those real persons, those persons like a doctor, where someone said in there, hey, teachers or doctors all read certifications, teachers go before a teaching board that says you did not do these things appropriate based on complaints. And this is an area where we don't see that same kind of demand for levels of expertise to understand the profession. And it's often based on, you know, someone's lived experience of what their exposures were to believe a person could have done those things. And it often isn't based in the expertise that I would want. I would say you would have more subject matter experts as part of these panels to help navigate a very difficult system of review.
Great, thank you for those answers. I will ask, I see we've got one more and we're already sort of over the flyer time. So what I'd like to do is, ask the question, and then I'll tack on my bit that also maybe will lead to final words from you. So the question is, have there been any crimes that have been picked up now since COVID is a concern? Questioner asks about specifically like sort of real estate scams taking advantage of people with COVID. I know I've read some stuff about domestic violence being more prevalent and everyone locked up in tight spaces with one another. And then I guess I'll just tack on slightly, up until we have a vaccine and life goes back to normal, what do you see as the biggest challenges facing your department during COVID times, particularly as we think about this theme of community policing and the relationship between the department and the people you are protecting and serving?
Let me go, Chief. So what we've, Chief Bradney got to get some breaking news, so I'm going to get some breaking news. You saw the news yesterday, and they covered it very well, that, and I hate the term, but it's what it is, porch pirates. It is the season, and it was all over the news yesterday. Albemarle County got hit very hard with somebody or some folks stealing a lot of packages off porches. Well, as I was sitting in here, I just had a press release go out that we made an arrest, and we've got a full attention to every one of those cases. So please, if I can say one thing, Professor, is be very careful about having packages delivered, because we've got one off the street that committed anywhere from 10 to 15, even more, out on the west side where I live. They came all the way in town and hit some. That's one of the things that's picking up. Domestic violence is picking up. And unfortunately, Albemarle County, our homicide rate's the highest it's ever been since I've been chief. And the last four homicides I've had has all been domestic-related homicides, unfortunately. Three of those, we've made an arrest, and one of them had to close exceptionally because one was a murder-suicide. And my fear is, and I tell everybody this, and I'm not afraid to say it, my fear is the longer we stay in COVID mode, where people can't go out and live their life, my fear is those things can happen. Unemployment could happen. It could drive people to do more things they normally wouldn't do. So we're keeping our eye on that. But one of the things I preached in a meeting yesterday was the outstanding resources we have here in the region, the mental health resources that we have, that people can pick a phone up and they can call and ask for help, you know, saying they're having a bad day. So I really take a lot of time to preach on that. So those are just, that's a gloss over of those things. But honestly, I just had a ComStat yesterday. Overall, my violent crime is down. I mentioned it earlier. My violent crime is what we capture is part one crime is murder, forcible rape, robbery, and aggravated assault. Everything in the county's been down. Matter of fact, it's at a 3-year low. We've made the fewest arrests we've made in the last 5 years since COVID. We're making the fewer traffic stops because we're being extra careful to make sure that we're only stopping people that for those egregious violations. And we've come out of that a little bit more, where the courts were able to open back up. So those are some of the things I'm seeing, but I'm keeping my eye on those patterns of potential domestic violence. You also, when you get a shut-in, Professor, as you know, alcohol abuse, substance abuse. And I will leave you with this thought. I learned yesterday and I don't know if Chief Bracken's experience in this, but our suicide rate has doubled this year since COVID as compared to 2018 suicide rate is doubled. So I'm a little concerned with that as well. So those are the things that we're keeping our eye on in Albemarle County. It was a great question.
Absolutely. We're experiencing the same things. We had 3 homicides in November. We had had none prior to that. Lots of violence. Domestic violence calls are increasing. Our mental health calls are increasing. Chief Lance started talking about, you know, they average about 70 a month. We did a search of one of our heavier consumers had dialed 911 for mental health intervention well over 90 times within the first 5 months, one person. So that's mm-hmm. going to increase. I'm concerned about not only decreases in unreported domestic violence, because there are some unreported abuse, elderly abuse, child abuse, where you would have these mandated reporters who would interact with children or elderly in social services on a daily basis because they're not now interacting in person. It's Zoom or some other method that we're going to have an undetected population that's going to be heavily traumatized and abused that we're not going to catch. Again, I agree. People will create their own economies if they feel as though they cannot have access to traditional economies and jobs and employment. They will create underground economies, whether that's through drugs, prostitution, you know, retail thefts and reselling those products again. People are desperate for food. What does that look like? And healthcare. That worries me. What also worries me is we started out the conversation about what does community policing look like? Well, part of that community policing is the being able to connect in a very real way, and not being able to do that will derail almost all of us. How do you build relationships through Zoom? We're trying to get much more creative with those ways, but that human connection is very much a part of what we do and how we do it. And that does concern me, although I am a huge proponent, you know, do the things that we need to do to be healthy so that we can get back to, you know, physically distance so that we can socially connect is how I use it. I don't even use the word socially distance because then it implies that we can't connect. So reframing even our language about it so that we don't create additional trauma and burdens in our psyche. Let's physically distance so we can socially connect. So those are the kinds of things I'm working on and thinking about into 2021.
Both chiefs, thank you so much to all of our attendees. Just fantastic questions. Thank you for participating. SSV, Jeff or Rich, do you have final words?
Yes, this has been an outstanding discussion, and I suspect we are well over our time, but we could probably go on for a long time to come. I was particularly struck by Chief Brackney's reference to grace. That's going to stay with me for a long time. I want to thank all of you, Professor Frampton, for doing an outstanding moderating job. The both chiefs, I certainly appreciate that you lead a busy, busy schedule, and we appreciate that you took the time to come with us today. I want to remind our audience that we have a kind of a follow-up or a companion program coming up on January 13th, the topic of which is criminal justice reform, and we will have both of the local Commonwealth attorneys at that time. We hope you will Zoom in, and we hope that you will consider becoming a member of SSV for the bargain figure of only $20 a year. We wish for all of you a safe and merry holiday. Thank you and have a great day.